I'm now 19, so living in Florida and water skiing for a living does sound pretty good to me. In the back of my mind, I am also thinking about the decathlon, even though I have never participated in one. LD has a reputation for training Olympic-caliber decathletes. I was versatile in high school. My best sport was always the pole vault, even if in my first attempt ever, I cleared the height by a mile, then promptly hit the crossbar smack in the face and cut myself. But I was on crappy teams, and the coach would turn to me and ask, "Hey, can you long jump?" "Yeah, why not?" "Can you high jump?" "Yeah, why not?" "Can you run out and get me a coffee before the next event, cream and extra sugar?" "Yeah, why not?" I was always a very helpful person. Even when I was a freshman, LD had been planting whispers in my ear about the decathlon. So now I wonder if the best course is to return to work for my father and go back to Graceland in the fall of 1969. I am staying in Richmond, Virginia, competing in a water skiing tournament. I have to make a decision. Water skiing in Florida or going back to college and training for something in which there is no guarantee of success. I get into my car, a 1956 Ford Fairlane convertible. I wish I had kept that car rather than the accordion. I'm headed to Interstate 95 with two choices: head north toward home and college, or head south to Florida. I'm almost at the on-ramps, and I still have not made up my mind. I'm in the right-hand lane to turn north. A car pulls up in the left-hand lane to turn south. If I want to go south, I have to either sharply apply the brakes or try to speed around it. The ramp for I-95 North is wide open, not another car on the road. I head north. There are many places in life where you see these crossroads. Everybody has them, although usually not in such a literal sense. At the time, it doesn't seem like that big of a decision, but then you look back at it and think, "Oh my God, what if I had turned left there? My entire life would have been different. I would not have won the Olympics. For better or worse, I would not have become an American hero. I would not have gotten lucrative endorsements from major corporations. I would not have had fame and celebrity. I would have been largely anonymous, but I also would have been free of expectation. I would have been far more free to be my authentic self. No one outside of family and a few close friends would have noticed or cared. By going right, I certainly prospered in a certain sense. By not going left, I failed to prosper at all where it counts the most, to celebrate my difference instead of driving away from it." After my return to Graceland in 1969 for my sophomore year, LD mercilessly bends my ear even more about the decathlon. In my heart, I still see the kid who had been the dim-witted dyslexic growing up and loved burying himself in his mother's closet. LD thinks that I have just enough athletic skill to be good, because he later says that I am not close to the best pure athlete he ever coached. He ranks me fifth. Fifth? Fifth! Had LD ever told me that, I probably would have quit, which is why he never told me. But he also later said that when it came to the combination of athleticism and desire, there was no equal. I did have more drive than anyone else. I also had more to prove, maybe because I had more to hide. LD becomes a father figure, not as a replacement for my own father, but as an extension of him. Wheedling, needling, pushing me to overcome fear, the hovering cloud that for all my outward jock-walk bullshit, I am neither strong nor particularly deserving of being strong. Just drop the damn ski. LD doesn't leave me alone, talking non-stop in his pork pie hat and oval-rimmed black glasses and coat and narrow tie. For some reason, he reminds me of a bobblehead, talking more than any person I have ever met in my life, except perhaps for me. It begins to make some sense. Sometimes in my head, I jot down the number of total points I think I could register in the decathlon, even though there are some events I have never even competed in. It adds up to 7,000, which would be a school record on my first try. I particularly like the number of events. 10. 10 different events. 10 events to train in any day or every day for as many days as you want. The 100 meters, the long jump, the shot put, the high jump, the 400 meters, the 110-meter hurdles, the discus, the pole vault, the javelin, the 1500 meters, in this exact order. You can get swallowed up in that. You can lose yourself in that. Whatever thoughts you have inside don't go away, but they do go numb. The Olympics? Who knows? In finding the drive to do something unimaginable, I am also finding the drive not to do something unimaginable. The Grand Diversion. I go home for winter break, and for the first time in my life see a sustained pathway. I am working for my dad to make a little money, and one day there is an emergency that brings me back to my other reality, in which it's time to stop the fantasy and get to work. The top of a tree on Bantam Lake in Connecticut has broken off. It is hanging on the limb below and has to be removed before it falls onto several high-tension electrical wires. A co-worker and I drive out to the site. It is about 0 degrees outside with a good 20-mile-per-hour wind whipping off the lake. The treetop is high in the air, dangling from the limb. These electrical wires are big boys, about 3/4 of an inch thick. You get close to them, and your hair kind of stands on end. Below the tree is nothing but rock wall. My dad goes out there with us. He tells us to cut down the treetop, and that's pretty much it. He has other jobs to attend to. Okay. I climb the tree, and I am freezing my ass off. All of the weight of the treetop is on this one limb that could snap at any second. Normally, I would try to position in above the limb to have a place to support my weight, then use a saw to take the limb down. But because the treetop has snapped off, there is no up above. I tentatively step out onto the limb, wearing a safety harness. I can see that this is ridiculously dangerous. It reminds me of my dad yelling at me to drop the damn ski. I was scared, but did not want to disappoint him. However, I'm thinking to myself that I have the possibility of excelling in the decathlon. I'm convinced now that I have an affinity for it. I want to train for it, for the first time in my life, push myself beyond what comes naturally. I've got other things to do besides stepping out onto a limb that might snap. I don't want to trim this tree. I don't particularly like trees. I really don't like climbing trees when it's like Siberia outside in eastern Connecticut. The saddle is attached to a rope, so it's easy for me to zip down. I go to my co-worker and tell him it's silly and I'm freezing to death and he should go do it. He looks at me like I'm crazy. So we go to the truck and turn the heater on and continue the discussion. I ain't going up there. I'm not going up there either. We are satisfied with our decision when all of a sudden my dad drives up. I roll the window down. What are you guys doing? Dad, I got up there. There's no safe place to cut the limb. It's freezing cold, that branch could break off easily, and you have nothing but high-tension wires and rock wall below it. I don't like it. I'm not doing it. The co-worker chimes in, I ain't doing it either. My dad looks at me. Don't do this to me. Dad, you're not going to convince me. This is a scary one, okay? Don't do this to me. Silence. He grabs the rope that is still attached to the tree in his jacket and tie. He shimmies up with two hands as high as he can in his jacket and tie. He balances himself on the limb in his jacket and tie. He takes the saw and perfectly drops the pieces in between the electrical wires in his jacket and tie. He shimmies down the rope hand over hand in his jacket and tie. He doesn't say a word in his jacket and tie. He gets in his car and drives away in his jacket and tie. I do think now about why my dad kept saying, "Don't do this to me." It may have been my defiance, which, given past history, was something he hated, or the realization that I was never going to work in the tree business. Not that that's what he had in mind. Maybe he thought I was cowardly. But I was also saying to my dad, "Please, don't do this to me. You have to let me live my life, whatever it is and wherever it goes. I need to do something that totally preoccupies me, removes from my mind what is churning inside. I have never competed in a decathlon. I may not be even good, but I am going to try like hell." Chapter 4. Who am I? I am looking in the mirror in a suite of the Queen Elizabeth Hotel in Montreal the morning after my Olympic win. I am naked with the gold medal around my neck. Now that it's over, who am I? I am trying to see if I feel different after winning the gold and setting a world record and already being offered a broadcasting job by ABC. The world's greatest athlete. Nobody can say that except the 13 gold medalists who have come before. But I don't feel particularly different. I look into the mirror and I still see what I always see to one degree or another. A person who, in working so hard to erase what is inside him, has overcome nothing. Now that the grand diversion of training for the Olympics is over, now that I have won, what happens next? Will I find something else to preoccupy me? Take the edge off? My wife, Christy, is sleeping in the next room. She thinks she knows me almost 4 years into our marriage. She does know me. She doesn't know me at all. My fingers feel like talons. My shoulders and arms humped and ridged with bony muscles. My hair, I hate my hair no matter how long I try to make it. I look into my eyes. I take a few steps closer and burrow into them. What do I see? What do you see? I still see Bruce Jenner. Not the Bruce Jenner the world now sees and wants and desires. The Bruce Jenner I never wanted and never desired. I am proud of my accomplishment. The day of the closing ceremonies at the Munich Olympics in 1972, where I finished 10th as a 22-year-old, even I was surprised to have gotten that far. I wondered, but what if I spend every minute of the next 4 years of my life training? What if I test myself to the limits to see how good I can become at something? I did exactly that. But now that I have won, how special it could possibly be if I could do it. I am a skilled athlete who works harder than the rest, who has to prove his manhood more than the rest. I may act self-assured, but I still am not. I may exude an attractive confidence, but I feel neither confident nor attractive. I still see Bruce Jenner. I look in the mirror and think of Christy. Her maiden name was Crownover. We met at the end of freshman year at Graceland. She was the daughter of a minister and, like me, lived a sheltered and cloistered life. My only sexual experience had been that one night my senior year in high school in the back seat of my mom's car. She was not aware of my gender issues when we started dating sophomore year, and I wasn't about to tell her. Not then. Christy was smart and assertive, the first in what would become a trend of wives who were also the same way. They took care of me, did everything for me, and I let them do everything for me, not simply because it made my life easier, but because of my own internal weakness that only got worse over time. I am averse to confrontation. My only comeback is too often a whiny petulance. I felt I did not deserve to be assertive. I did not deserve to be proud. All of my marriages had a distinct pattern, compatibility and love, followed by eventual unraveling. Christy and I fell in love quickly. When we made love, it was warm and gentle, two beginners discovering our physicality. I also had my sights set on the 1972 Olympics, a thought ridiculous to everyone except LD and Christy. That was when the grand diversion began to kick into gear, training every afternoon after classes from 3 to 6 p.m., only quitting so I could get to the cafeteria for dinner before it closed. We moved in together, a huge step given the moral values of Graceland. The school had only a year earlier sponsored its first dance ever, girls on one side of the room and boys on the other, and everyone terrified of the middle. I didn't tell my parents. She did not tell her parents. We did not discuss marriage, except that I knew an athlete whose wife supported him so he could train, and I felt that was wrong to use his spouse like that. Christy disagreed, saying that if a husband and wife were working together toward a goal they both shared, then it did not matter who was supporting whom financially, which is primarily why Christy went on to become a flight attendant for United Airlines. At the end of December 1972, several months after the Munich Olympics, we got married. We were both in our early 20s, and I think we both had the same attitude that if you were going to go out into the big bad world, it was a lot easier to do it with someone else. We had our wedding at the chapel at Graceland where I was finishing up my degree. There were about 20 guests, including my parents and her parents. Then we drove to Des Moines, where we had reserved a suite at the Holiday Inn, which for us was very swanky. The suite was not quite what we expected, since it actually had no bed. So we switched rooms, and I carried Christy over the threshold, and by then it was 10 p.m. We hadn't eaten dinner, so we tried to order room service, but it was closed, and then we tried takeout, but every place had a two-hour wait. So we went to McDonald's for an intimate wedding night supper. We were planning to splurge on a trip to Hawaii, but then our car gave out, and we spent pretty much all our money to fix it. But we still managed to spend a week there on $200. I told Christy in 1973 about my gender issues. It wasn't by choice. She was putting clothes away and noticed a rubber band on one of the hooks of her bra. When she asked me about it, my first response was noncommittal. Gee, I don't know. It was not very convincing. Rubber bands don't mysteriously appear on the hooks of bras. There was no way out. That's why the rubber band, because I've been wearing your clothes. She was totally shocked. She didn't know anyone who cross-dressed, neither did I, and had very little understanding of the whole thing. So did I. But she was overwhelmed with compassion and gratitude that I trusted her enough to tell her. Of course, she was also relieved that I was not cross-dressing in front of her and never would. I tried to pass it off as just a phase, a fantasy that some men have, and hey, all men have fantasies anyway. Christy processed it as simply a piece of information, and then it was time for me to go back to being a guy. We moved to San Jose so I could do nothing but train 8 hours a day for the Montreal Olympics. We picked out an apartment roughly 20 yards from the San Jose City College track. All I had to do was climb over the fence and begin training. On a good day, I could throw the discus into the middle of the field from our little third-floor balcony. Together, we formed a true marital partnership. Her powerful demeanor was an antidote to my soft one. She was the primary breadwinner while I fanatically trained, and she acted as buffer and protector, since it was my inclination to say yes to everything, and Christy was the one who stepped in and said no. As the Olympics neared, the media became interested and began to play up the partnership angle. There were stories here and there, and then ABC's Rune Arledge amped it up. The president of ABC Sports single-handedly took the Olympics and transformed it from an event of minimal interest into a television sensation, the fee for rights going from $597,000 for the 1964 Winter Games to $25 million for the Montreal Games. Arledge committed the network to an unprecedented 76.5 hours of coverage. He was the father of the overcoming adversity narrative where the athlete defied all odds, cue the violin schmaltz poems, or what networks called up close and personal. He saw them as potentially enormous rating boosters, and in particular, he saw Christy and I as the stars of the show. I would not be at the Olympics without Christy. I would not be staring into the mirror with a gold medal around my neck. But I also wonder if now that the grand diversion is over, will the woman living inside me still be content to remain quiet, or will she want more? And if that happens, if my gender issues only heighten, what will happen to Christy and me? I look in the mirror, and there is something dreamlike about it all. Bruce did it. He actually did it. He beat the defending champion, Mykola Avilov, of the Soviet Union. It was more than simply defeating Avilov. It was beating the red menace of the Soviet Union at the peak of the Cold War. Roughly a year and a half earlier, in April 1975, South Vietnam had fallen to communist forces. The Soviets are intent on spreading their domination by military force, such as the invasion of Afghanistan 3.5 years later. The Olympics have become more of a test of nationalist prowess and strength than ever before. The medal count has never been more important, the barometer by which countries are considered strong or weak. The Soviets were on their way to win 49 gold medals, East Germany 40, and the United States 34. The overall performance was a terrible disappointment, particularly in track, where the American men's and women's teams netted one individual gold medal. The days in Montreal were winding down, and the only major events left were the finals in men's basketball and the decathlon. I was the overwhelming favorite to win. At the 1976 U.S. Olympic trials in Eugene, I set a world record. I have lost one decathlon in 3 years because I was bored, and losing was actually good because it renewed my commitment. Because of all the disappointment in the U.S. team, it was falling on me to salvage the country's performance. It wasn't only that we needed to defeat the Soviets. Our country was convulsing in the aftermath of Watergate, the resignation of Richard Nixon as president, and the debacle of Vietnam. Our political system had failed us. Our once sacred values had failed us. We felt weak and confused. We were a country adrift. Sports could help right us. It is that powerful. Just to make the pressure a little bit more intense, the country had celebrated its bicentennial just a few weeks earlier. Patriotism was at its peak. Heroes were at a premium. But it got to me when I watched teammate Dave Roberts, the overwhelming favorite in the pole vault, lose because of heavy rain. The rain? How could I control the weather when the decathlon started 3 days later? Oh, Christy, I've got to carry the whole United States. My knees buckled. My body felt fragile, crushed. For the first time, I wondered if I could handle the pressure. I started crying as Christy held me. She tried to encourage me. Then we both realized the same thing. It rains, it rains. It snows, it snows. It hails, it hails. The ground collapses beneath us. The ground collapses beneath us. There was not a thing I could do about any of it, except go out and do it. As usual, the waiting for the damn thing to begin was excruciating. I entered the stadium and psyched myself up and worked out a little bit until I realized that no amount of working out was going to help at this moment. Either you have trained enough or you haven't. Either you embrace the pressure or you choke. But I still had to wait for endless inspections by the International Olympic Committee. Length of spikes, height of soles for the shoe used in the long jump, making sure the number I had been assigned matched the master set. It only made it harder to maintain focus. I watched the first heat of the 100 meters on a closed-circuit television. Avilov, with his drooping mustache, was in the first heat. I hoped it would slow him down. I would have shaved the damn thing off. False start. False start. False start. This was good. Very good. Somebody was over-anxious. The fourth start was clean. Avilov, responsible for one of the false starts, was slow and lumbering off the mark. He was a step behind after 10 meters and only lagging farther behind. He finished in 11.23 seconds, significantly worse than his Munich time of 11 seconds. Decathlons are measured by personal bests, and Avilov hasn't come close. The second heat. I ran 10.94 seconds, the best 100 meters I had ever run in my life under the conditions, 70 points more than Avilov. I had him. I knew I had him with 9 events still to go. His concentration was off. Mine was like a tight wire. So that was when I knew I was going to win. The lever of momentum fast and furious. The golden moment of omnipotence that the athlete feels when he can race to the moon and be back in time for dinner with a side trip to the sun. I look in the mirror and think about what I did after I actually won. A spectator ran out from the stands and handed me a small American flag. I was surprised by the gesture. I wanted to run a victory lap, and I had the flag of my country with me, and I was not going to hand it to someone else to hold or put it down, because that would be disrespectful, so I circled the track with it. Legend has it that I was the first American Olympic champion in history to take a victory lap waving the flag. But that image, unplanned and so tiny in the course of a life, is what defines me, what people remember most. The flag is an extension of me, the patriotism and pride I felt as I circle the track, becoming patriotism and pride all Americans can feel. We all just won. I look in the mirror, and I can still see the tears in the eyes of my parents when I find them in the stands. But in the eyes of my mom, as sincere as my dad sometimes is not, I didn't see euphoria, but a split second of fear. Fear that fame would change me no matter how much I resisted. Fear that I would become addicted to fame no matter how much I resisted. Fear that my ability to make emotional connections and reach out, already tenuous, would completely disappear as I am swallowed up into the public. Fear that the attention, no matter how much I tried to reject it, would become an addiction. I might be imagining it, but hearing my mother many years later, maybe I'm not. When it was finally decided that he was going to Graceland, I kind of figured he'd wind up to be a coach, a college coach, probably track. And do you know something? I sometimes wished that had happened. Fame and fortune takes the family apart. And I thought, you know, if he had come in second in Montreal, no one would know his name, and wouldn't it be wonderful if he had just had a much more normal life, got married, had his kids and a closer relationship? When our kids are growing up, we wish for them to have fame and fortune and be successful, and we think of it monetarily mostly, that that brings happiness. But I think in my head now, be careful what you wish for, because you might just get it. I don't wonder about that now when I look in the mirror with that medal around my neck. All of that is yet to come. I only know that I am naked and about to become an American hero. October 14, 2015. Breast forms. I am on the phone with my stepdaughter Kim. She asks me what I am up to. I tell her I am about to go through the downstairs closet of my Malibu home to get rid of what Bruce used to wear. She says to wait and we'll be right over. I am not entirely sure why, although I don't think it is because she needs more clothing. She arrives. She wants to save several items for herself and her sisters as a way to remember who I once was, almost as if there has been a death in the family. It is mostly everyday stuff I used to wear, plus the suits I donned when I gave speeches. It is the same thing she did when her father Robert died, carting away several bags of his clothing to forever honor his memory. I don't know what she will ultimately do with them. Keep them tucked away in a remote corner somewhere, or probably forget about them, as is the fate of most keepsakes. Getting rid of the clothing has been much harder than I thought. It was not nearly as exhilarating or exciting as I initially thought it would be, that feeling that, this is so great, I can finally get rid of what Bruce wore since I don't need them anymore. Instead, there has been an undeniable feeling of loss even for me. So maybe there has been a death in the family. It is interesting to me the degree to which writers and commentators on transgender issues speak on my behalf and tell readers what I am thinking or feeling without ever talking to me. Right after I transitioned, Meredith Ramirez-Tolusen wrote on Fusion.net that Bruce was a so-called dead name and should never be used again. It's a matter of basic courtesy, wrote Tolusen. Jenner hasn't just definitively announced her true gender, but also let go of a male identity that she's felt alienated from since early childhood. If she thinks of her life in her male role as a lie, then it's also true that her former name, the one that stands in for that life, is also a lie. Bruce was not a lie. Bruce existed. What I did lie about, or at least obfuscate, was Caitlin's existence. Tolusen suggested that the headline should have been, Transgender Olympic Champion Announces Her Name, Caitlin, which is not only a very big mouthful, but untrue, since I was not a transgender Olympic champion at that time, but Bruce Jenner. If I were a transgender woman, I would have been stripped of the medal for competing in a men's event. Bruce won the Olympics. I lived as a man before I transitioned. I had a life as Bruce, and the more comfortable I become as Caitlin, the more I actually embrace Bruce as a valuable part of my life. I obviously don't want to be called Bruce, but I am not going to bury him and send him to the dead name pile. There has to be some reality here, at least for me. You can't simply blot out your past, your beliefs, your interests. The life that you lived as a father and dad and husband, the accomplishments and failures do not get sent to the trash with a click of the mouse. I remember crying when I received my new birth certificate from the state of New York stating that I am female and giving my name as Caitlin Marie Jenner. They were tears of joy in seeing the correct gender marker on such an important legal document. But there were also tears of sadness that Bruce was gone, the birth certificate being official proof. After the Diane Sawyer interview on ABC and the subsequent Vanity Fair cover and story, I got a letter from a trans woman named Jody who lives in Los Angeles. She transitioned 15 years ago. Jody told me perhaps the most instructive story I have heard from a trans person. The subject of gender came up. Jody said it was 3 or 4 years after her transition when she put her head to the pillow one night. It was a night like any other except for something momentous. She had gone the whole day without thinking about gender. I have not reached that point. I don't want to give the impression that I am thinking, is this really me? But I do think about gender. I am firmly on the side of womanhood now, but I am not a woman, nor will I ever be. I am a trans woman. There is a difference. I never menstruated or had menopause. I obviously cannot give birth. I was never screwed out of a job because of the sexism that is still pervasive. Is my gender female? Yes. Has it always been female? Yes. I use the women's restroom because I am a woman. I changed the gender on my birth certificate to female because I am a woman. But it's a different kind of womanhood for me. And that will never change. I'm fine with that. It doesn't diminish Caitlin. I'm glad when Kim carts off several bags of clothing to her car. I need the closet space. Plus the best stuff, all the athletic gear I wore over the years as Bruce, I'm still keeping. I never told her about the drawer full of breast forms and hip pads I used to wear. They are in the bedroom closet where all of Caitlin's clothes now hang. I don't need any of them now, so I wonder why I even kept them. But then I realized why. They symbolize my struggle when I was Bruce, but they are also part of the journey of my life. I can't ignore them. I don't want to ignore them. I pack them up into a box. I know exactly where I'm going to put them. In the garage, next to the accordion. Chapter 5. Golden Boy. It doesn't even take a day before the sports writers, intent on finding a story to take out of the Olympics, start furiously tapping their typewriter keys. They need a happy ending. America needs a happy ending. The aura of male invincibility they ascribe to me is already in high gear. I am an athlete who comes along once in a millennium, or so they write. Bruce Jenner's next move should be the rental of a Brinks truck. Prince Valiant with muscles. Imagine, a movie. Our hero is handsome beyond right. His wife is a beautiful blonde who wears a yellow t-shirt with the words, "Go Jenner Go" on the back. Our hero is winning the decathlon, the event that from Jim Thorpe's day has been the measure of the world's greatest athlete. David Kindred, The Courier Journal of Louisville. Bruce Jenner, the golden boy from San Jose, California. Robert Fache, Washington Post. Bruce Jenner of San Jose, California, wants to be a movie or television star. After his record-breaking victory in the Olympic decathlon today, he probably can be anything he wants. Frank Litsky, The New York Times. Hollywood Handsome, Associated Press. Bruce Jenner always says the right thing at the right time, no matter what the place. Everything that glitters is Bruce Jenner. Phil Hirsch, Chicago Daily News. This is a couple America will not be allowed to forget. Kenneth Denlinger, The Washington Post. Jenner is twirling the nation like a baton. He and his wife, Christy, are so high up on the pedestal of American heroism, it would take a crane to get them down. Tony Kornheiser, New York Times. The only thing missing is that I have this woman living inside me. I don't like what I see when I dress up. Big arms, legs long but too muscular, no clothes that really fit. It is all great for the decathlon, but not very good for a night out on the town. But the last thing I can do is physically alter my appearance in any way. The sports writers won't tolerate it. America won't tolerate it. I will continue to play the game of Bruce, the demands upon him never greater. That's actually good, a new zone of preoccupation. But being busy is only a distraction, not a solution. Otherwise, the sports writers nailed it. I am not innocent in all the hoopla. I know I am photogenic and telegenic and wholesome, actually because I am photogenic and telegenic and wholesome. And so is my wife. Our partnership is a legitimate story, and the media laps it up. We play along with it even though we are beginning to have problems. We do interviews together and appearances together and present ourselves as the ultimate apple pie couple. A few in the media suggest that I had a game plan in place before the Olympics on how to capitalize if I won. Did I hope there would be opportunities? Of course. Remember, these were the days of true amateurism, when there were no financial sponsorships. But I had no idea what they would be, nor did I care. I only wanted to win. Christy only wanted to win. If I had never gotten a single endorsement after the games, that would have been fine. Now there are opportunities. Some are beyond silly. General Mills actually wanted me to jump out of an oversized Wheaties box for the sake of some cheap promotion. but I do intuitively understand the media game and the fame game and the endorsement game. It is all a game, and you have to play it. I am all too aware of what happened to Mark Spitz, the American swimmer who won 7 gold medals at the 1972 Games and set 7 world records in every event in which he participated. The hope was that Spitz would become the first American Olympian to parlay his performance into a fortune. It was projected that Spitz might get $5 million in endorsements, and there were hyperbolic predictions of a major film career. But he just didn't have the personality for it. He scored a legendary bomb on a Bob Hope special 2 months after the games and quickly proved to the film industry that not only could he not act, but he didn't like acting. He also burned a lot of bridges with companies he endorsed. He was never very good at the shadow dance with either the media or sponsors, which entails being humble and endlessly appreciative. I once heard him say he spent 15 years on his swimming and 15 minutes on his speeches. It just didn't seem like he was cut out for this kind of life. I try not to make the same mistakes as Spitz. Already at this point in my life, I know I am a good actor, even if I have never appeared in a single thing. If I have successfully hidden my true self from the world, how hard can it be to do film or television? At least I know I can cross-dress. I prove it when I do a Bob Hope special on NBC after the games. I appear with Bob and former Los Angeles Rams defensive lineman turned actor Merlin Olsen as the Melody Maids. The gag is that we are going to appear with Bob in drag together, which for me isn't a gag, but something of a godsend. I have to be careful not to show too much enthusiasm, so I play it cool. Guys, dressing up like a woman. Yuck. Bob looks the best of the three of us. Merlin's beard is not working for him. Our wigs and dresses are purposely ridiculous. But the red heels, I think, not only look good on me, but also fit, so I steal them after the show. 40 years later, I am ready to return them. It is a tremendous high to go out and conquer the world physically. I feel like a gladiator going into the arena and being the only one left standing. I don't want to diminish that, but the games have only made me feel strong physically. They don't make me feel strong emotionally. I don't feel like I remotely have my act together, a place in life that truly fits. I still feel weak. I still feel unworthy. But suck it up, little Brucie. Suck it up. Play the game. You've always been good at games. So work it, little Brucie. Work it. And by the way, tell the woman inside you to keep her mouth shut. In the aftermath of Montreal, I become a staple of the talk show circuit, often appearing with Christie. Good Morning America with David Hartman as host and Billy Carter as guest. The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and guests John Davidson, remember? Madeline Rue, don't remember, and Stephen Landisberg, Barney Miller, right? A week-long stint on the Mike Douglas Show with Christie as co-host. Dinah, opposite a repeat of Marcus Welby, M.D., The Edge of Night, and The Bugs Bunny Show. I have my portrait taken by the world-renowned photographer Francesco Scavullo for a book he is working on and spontaneously do a handstand. I am mobbed on the streets of New York for autographs, surrounded by a chain of whispers of, "There's Bruce Jenner," at every major airport in America. I talk to everyone, but the talk is small and getting smaller. Like Christie, I wonder how much is left for me after the exhaustion of being besieged. My business manager, George Wallach, is not making it any easier to have a few quiet days off. He says in print that I have as much film potential as Robert Redford and that my reception in New York was similar to that after Charles Lindbergh had completed his historic nonstop flight to Paris. I have rejected several endorsements offered immediately after the games, as well as other business opportunities. I want to be in this for the long run and not look like a money whore, but George's public boasting is running the risk of the same oversaturation as Spitz. I need to take it slow. But it's hard to keep your head straight when soon after the games, the producers of the film Superman want me to test for the title role. It's a little bit of a stretch. Actually, it's absurd. I have never done a screen test in my life. I'll have to see the script, though I think I can identify with the part, I quip. I like new challenges, and I am hoping to act someday, so Christy and I fly to Rome. They have me do a fight scene with a stand-in playing the evil villain Lex Luthor. Then they feed me lines. They tell me I'm great, and I think they mean it. But there is an immediate problem. They want me to cut my hair for the role, and I won't do it. My hair is one of the few ways I can feel my femininity, and it is these tentacles that keep me going, make me feel some tiny piece of my authentic self. After not hearing from the producers for roughly a year, I learn the role is given to Christopher Reeve, and at that point, I don't particularly care whether I will be cast or not. Not caring, another familiar motif in my life after the games. I am living the dream, and sometimes it feels like a dream, or at least enough of a diversion to suppress my gender issues. I miss the grand diversion terribly, that feeling of waking up every day and knowing exactly what I was going to do. I don't know how I am going to replace it, although I have given it considerable thought. I knew I wanted out of sports, which is why I left my vaulting pole in the Olympic Stadium. It's always better to finish an athletic career at the top instead of being shoved out at the bottom when it's obvious to everyone except to the athlete that the skill is gone. I don't want to get caught in the trap of not preparing for when your career is finished. I have seen it too many times and witnessed the devastation too many times. You stay terrified of doing something different. You are coddled for so much of your life that you have no clue how to live on your own. Plus, let's be honest, there isn't much demand for a decathlete outside of the games. It takes 2 days, there are 10 events, and anybody who says they truly understand the scoring is lying. I want to leverage my athletic success if I can, not depend on it. I officially sign with ABC in October 1976, where I will ultimately become a jack-of-all-trades and master of none. I like learning the new skill of broadcasting and being on air, but I don't lock on to it. There is no mission to be the best. I have lost my ultra-competitive instinct, odd for someone who had such a strong one. As much as I love the grand diversion, I have concluded that it can be dangerous to become so obsessed with competitiveness and winning. It stunts you from ever growing as a person. All you are on Earth for is to train, score points, win. Nothing else mattered for me when I was determined to win the decathlon in Montreal, which I know was a tremendous source of frustration for Christy and my parents. When I was with them, I wasn't present in the moment, but far off in my own moment. Faster, higher, stronger. As much as I loved the single-mindedness of that, I never want to be that single-minded again. And yet I need to be single-minded in something if I am to keep my gender issues in check, so it is a difficult contradiction. I am single-minded so I can live. I am not single-minded so I can live. Caught once again in the middle. I see right away my limitations in broadcasting. The demon of dyslexia still intent on humiliating me. The past always prologue. ABC wants to try me out as the permanent co-host of Wide World of Sports with Frank Gifford in Los Angeles and myself in New York. We do a practice run, and it is clear I cannot handle the teleprompter because I am a slow reader. The words scroll through the monitor too quickly. I cannot keep pace. I try to get over the hurdle of the teleprompter. I learn to memorize the script and make progress, but from the very beginning, I am marginalized. My first assignment is on a show called Battle of the Network Stars as an on-field reporter offering commentary and asking contestants how they feel after they do running and swim relays and 100-yard dashes and tugs of war and hitting a golf ball with accuracy. The show debuts on November 13, 1976. It is wacky and kind of oddly wonderful. A celebrity Olympics with animated fireworks at the beginning in which the participants show up in limos. There is no teleprompter to work with, which is good. I do well given my inexperience. People respond positively to my friendly and casual style. I feel good about myself, and when that happens, my gender issues go into semi-hibernation. I feel as close to a sense of peace as I can get. For exactly 17 days after the show's debut. My brother Bert and I have never been particularly close for much of our lives. He is 8 years younger, for one thing. He also has the misfortune of living in the shadow and footsteps of my exploits. He is a very good athlete himself, but he is tired of the endless comparisons in football and basketball and track. My mom remembers it best. It was difficult for Bert, and I blame these damn teachers and coaches. Bert being so much younger than Bruce, and Bruce already in high school and the star. Coaches would come down the hall and run into Bert and say, "Hey, young Jenner, we're waiting for you." What a lot of pressure was on that little boy that he has to live up to when he hasn't had a chance to get started. He was a very good athlete, but he would not compete in anything that Bruce did. He wouldn't compete in it. He was the fastest on the track in intramurals, but he wouldn't go out for track. And the coaches wanted him to and pressured him to, but he wouldn't budge. He was built just like Bruce. Actually, I think he was better looking, too. Bert reacts by doing the opposite of everything I did. I played football, he plays soccer. I water skied, he snow skis. I was a mediocre student. He is a very good student. I am frustrated that he shies away from certain competitive sports because I know how good he can be. There is tension between us, and the emotional distance only intensifies after I leave for Graceland at 18 when he is 10. We both share vivid memories of the one and only time in my life I got drunk as a senior in high school and slept with him in the same bed because I could not make it to the top bunk. He was mad at me, and I was mad at him for not moving to the top bunk when I asked. From then on, I only see him when I come home. About 9 months before the Montreal Games, our relationship improves. I am more mature, and he has just graduated from high school, and he asks to talk to me privately one day, telling me that he wants to come to California. If Christy and I end up there permanently after the games, and live with us. His plan is to work for a year to establish residency, and then apply to an in-state school at virtually no cost. I like the idea. I like it because it will be a way of drawing us closer. He is there in Montreal with my parents, Christy, and about 60 friends and family. Recently, I saw the picture in Sports Illustrated that was taken of the entourage after I won. They were easy to pick out since they were all wearing yellow t-shirts with Go Jenner Go on the back. Very proud canaries. I could pick out everyone in the picture, except for Bert. He wasn't there. I could not find him. Where was he? Why wasn't he there? Where had he gone? Bert's bags are all packed on November 30, 1976. They are neatly side by side in his room like standing soldiers, ready to go. I am in town to do a speaking engagement in Canton, Connecticut, where he is living with my parents. We have tickets for an afternoon flight to Los Angeles out of Hartford. Christy and I have just bought a house in Malibu, and Bert is going to live on the first floor. Because I am going to be in Canton for several days, a local car dealer, knowing my weakness for Porsches, drops off a 911 model so I can have a car to drive. I let Bert use it a little bit, For an 18-year-old kid who has just graduated from high school, few things in life, if anything, are sweeter than tooling around town in a Porsche 911. Bert is also responsible. He won't do anything stupid. The speech is at 9 a.m. We are leaving for the airport several hours later, so Bert says he can take care of filling the car with gas so the tank will be full when it is returned to the dealer. The service station is only about a mile away, and on the route is Canton High School. Bert cannot resist driving in front of the entrance. He sees a girl he knows that is a good friend. "Hey, jump in. We'll go down and get some gas, and I'll bring you right back." Her name is Judith Hutchings, and she is 16. She hops in and off they go down a back road that he has driven hundreds of times. I am wrapping up my speech. My dad is in the audience, listening. He cannot see the back of the room, but I can, and it seems strange when three policemen walk in. They ask if they can speak to us privately and then take us into a classroom. We still don't know what is going on until one of them says, "There's been a serious accident involving your son. You should get to the hospital right away." I drive. My dad is next to me. He is banging on the dashboard as hard as he can, and I think he is going to break his hand. I remember him saying, "God damn it, God damn it, this is going to kill your mother." Bert has a special place in my mother's soul. She pleaded with Bill to have another child when he thought two was enough. There is a tenderness to Bert that steals her heart, a sweet and gentle softness I never possessed as her oldest son. He does what he is told. He does not argue. He even takes calculus. My mom is at home when the phone rings. It is the police. They tell her that one of her sons has been in an accident and has been transported to the hospital. They never give a name, so she does not know whether it's Bert or me. She comes out of the apartment pale and shaking. A next-door neighbor, a young mother, sees her and asks what happened, and she tells her there has been an accident involving one of her sons. The young mother can tell she is terrified. "You are not driving." She takes my mom to the nearest hospital in Farmington. She learns that it is Bert who is injured, but he isn't there. He has been taken to a larger hospital in Hartford. They don't mention to her that it's a trauma center. Bert had taken the Porsche on Old Canton Road. Because the road was old, it was also narrow and curvy. There was a rise, and Bert took it too fast. The Porsche went airborne and then crooked. It hit a tree and then a rock wall of sizable boulders. Hutchings was flung from the car and killed instantly. Bert suffered critical injuries. My dad is typically stoic as we drive, with his residual toughness. He says little, if anything. He had seen so much horror in the war. I wonder if that is what he is thinking now, and maybe trying to brace himself for whatever happened. Although I also know that whatever he saw, it never involved his son, his flesh and blood. My mom is already there in a waiting room when we arrive. They try to give her tranquilizers, but she refuses, because there is no way she is going to put up with that. One of the neurosurgeons comes in. My mom remembers it vividly. "You get to the hospital and a surgeon comes down and talks to you and says, 'I hate to tell you this, but your son cannot live.' Oh, God. And then you sit around for hours as Bill and I talk and the doctors say, 'We have him on life support. We can keep his heart going and his breathing going for who knows how long, because he's so young and so strong, but there are no brain waves. Bill and I talk it over for a few hours and go back and forth into his room. He was laying there. They had him all cleaned up and the damage was to the back of his head, so you can't see it. And he's laying on the bed and you say to yourself, 'My God, there's nothing wrong with him. He can't be dying.'" Dad and Mom make their decision. We want him taken off life support. My mom puts her cheek on her youngest son's cheek before he dies. She whispers to him for the final time, "I love you, wherever you are now." It's just like my mom described. He still looks beautiful when the machines are dismantled. He still looks just like Bert, the 18-year-old kid who has figured out the next step of his life. The Bert I am just getting to know. The Bert who, in his yearbook, which I found and looked at the day after he died, used a lyric from Cat Stevens' Peace Train as his favorite words of inspiration. Now I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be. Something good has begun. That same day, my dad and I go to the funeral home to pick out a casket. I have never been to a funeral home before. I have never picked out a casket before. But now I am, for my brother. I have struggled with the issue of guilt. What if I had never taken the car from the dealer? What if I had never lent it to Bert? Why did he pick up an innocent young woman who had her whole life in front of her? Why did he drive so carelessly? But never in my life have I ever beat myself up about it. It is a mechanism of protection, I know, but I have come to the conclusion that it was Bert's day to die, just as, on the beaches of Normandy, it was my father's day not to. It was the way it was. That's what happened. The accident had a fate and will of its own. Two people tragically lost their lives, and my brother was the one responsible. But I have to move on because so much of my life has been about moving on. Get over it, get through it, don't show outward emotion because it only leads to inner emotions, and I must keep those in check. The floodgates open and I am done. It is why I could not bear to view the casket and not wait to leave town when the funeral was over. For many months after his passing, my mom could not bear to go inside his room, so it remained the way it was, with those bags packed and ready to go like standing soldiers for an afternoon flight to California he never got to take and never will. Chapter 6. What goes up? I am waiting for it. No story lasts forever, and the one of God and country and Bruce going out and winning the games and becoming the golden boy and Prince Valiant and the hero and the face of the Wheaties box and having a lovely flight attendant wife who steadfastly supported him through thick and thin is too good to last forever. The media loves you until they hate you. They elevate, then denigrate. They fixate, then grow bored. They make you larger than life, then smaller than life. Anybody in the public eye knows that. The guillotine of celebrity. Try to prolong your reign for as long as possible before they take your head. I just don't want to make it easier for them. But in the late 1970s and early 1980s, there is ammunition if they can locate the cash. There are whispers of Bruce the playboy and Bruce the asshole. So I am waiting. But you are still not prepared for it. The only solace is that after 6 months, the media will move on to something else. Remember, this is pre-internet. The attention span of the media now is more like 6 minutes, but it only takes 6 minutes for a story to go around the world and back. I knew this going in.